I used to say that when I taught all the content in this class, and I'm saying it now when this is one of the three lectures I'm giving this semester. It is just hard stuff because it's not black and white. It's very abstract. You can't hold it in your hands. You just have to trust me that this is how things work. And so I'm going to tell you now that by the end of this lecture, you're going to walk out of here feeling a little numb. If you hang with me about halfway before I lose you, you're doing really good. And then I hope you pick up the rest of it when you go back and start studying on your own. But this is hard stuff. Hemodynamics is not new, though, right? Even since first level, you may have heard a nurse say, or you may have said that your patient was hemodynamically stable, and you knew what that meant, right? What does it mean if a patient's hemodynamically stable? Y'all know what that means? Y'all don't know what that means? What if your instructor asks you, is your patient hemodynamically stable? What would you look at to answer that question?
Heart rate, blood pressure.
They're vital signs. So their blood pressure, their heart rate, that tells me if my patient's hemodynamically stable. So you started with vital signs in first level. You started learning about those vital signs in preclinical. But what happens when you get to fourth level is we kind of pull back the curtain and show you the rest of the story. There are a lot of hemodynamics that are going on. And every patient that you have ever come in contact with, and each of us here in this room, we just don't have the ability to monitor all of those. It's not until you get to critical care that you actually see numbers for those values. So hemodynamics is the study of blood flow through the heart. Y'all already know, through the system, through the heart and the body. And the parts of it are your heart rate, which y'all know that that is how many times your heart beats in a minute, right? Your stroke volume, which is the volume of blood that your heart puts out with each beat. And stroke volume is usually about 70 mils. 70 cc's per beat is about normal for an adult. We all know if we started talking about kids or babies, that would be different because they're smaller. Which is also linked to your ejection fraction. Your ejection fraction is the percentage of blood that your left ventricle squeezes out with each contraction. So we don't expect 100%. Normal ejection fraction is about 60 to 70%. If it gets less than 50% and the patient has symptoms, then we'll say the patient's in congestive heart failure. How do we measure an ejection fraction? An echocardiogram, you're right. Or we can go to cath lab and measure it directly, but unless there's another reason to be in cath lab, we're not going to do that. But they do measure it while you're in cath lab. We also know cardiac output. Y'all all know the formula for cardiac output, right? Y'all don't ask me your words. This is a pretty interactive group, I can tell. Y'all are not working people, are you? Heart rate times stroke volume. How many times your heart beats a minute times how much your body is putting out with each beat tells you your cardiac output, which is the volume of blood that your heart ejects in a minute. And that makes sense. Right? Because if you take the volume from one beat, multiply it by the number of times it's beating, then that's how much you're doing in a minute. But this is going to be a new one for you. Systemic vascular resistance. If you think about, and I'll tell you now, if I had told y'all at the beginning of this lecture that I want everybody to pull out a sheet of paper and start with the right atrium and go through the pathway of blood through the heart and body, including every valve and major vessel, if the thought of that makes you sick in your stomach, that's where you need to start studying. You have to have memorized that before you can understand this. It is not possible to understand hemodynamics if you don't know the anatomy that is creating those hemodynamics. So if you study with a study group, start with that. Everybody pull out a sheet of paper, see if you can do it. And if not, you'll need to shore that up first, because you're never going to be able to understand hemodynamics. So if we picture that this room that we're sitting in is the left ventricle, and we are all red blood cells, right? And there's a door coming in, and there's a door going out. So coming into the left ventricle is a valve that brings blood into from the left atrium. And then coming out of the left ventricle, there's a valve going out into the aorta, right? So that's our aortic valve that we're going through to go out into the aorta. When the left ventricle squeezes, thank you for that. When the left ventricle squeezes and it opens that aortic valve, we have to all get out of this room and out into that hallway to go out to the aorta to the rest of the body, right? The amount of resistance that we have to overcome to get out that door is our systemic vascular resistance, which is a part of your afterload, because you should be thinking, I thought that was afterload. You learned about afterload in second level. You're learning about systemic vascular resistance this semester because now we're going to be able to measure it. The systemic vascular resistance is part of your afterload, and it really is a measurement of the tension in the muscles of the arteries that your body has to overcome to push blood forward from the ventricle. So if I have a patient who gets septic and their vessels dilate out and get all big and floppy, what do you think happens to your systemic vascular resistance? The vessels relaxed and got all big and floppy, it goes down. That's exactly right. If I give you dopamine and cause your vessels to suck in and get smaller to raise your blood pressure, what happens to your systemic vascular resistance? It goes up. It's not rocket science, but it is new. And so there's going to be a lot of definitions and vocabulary in this lesson as well. Then you have your blood pressure, which y'all know what that is. You also need to know what your mean arterial pressure is, and could you figure that if you were given a blood pressure? You know, systolic plus diastolic divided by 3 is your mean arterial pressure. So when we're looking at cardiac output specifically, I already gave you the formula, stroke volume times heart rate. So theoretically, if my heart rate goes up, what happens to my cardiac output?
Up.
It goes up. If my heart rate goes up, mathematically, my cardiac output goes up. I'll catch up to where your head's at in just a minute because we've already talked about this. So if we were machines, if we were robots, and our heart rate began to increase, our cardiac output would increase, bless you, and so will yours to a certain extent. But I want you to think about the heart. You think about the atrium and the ventricles. I don't know anything about football, so y'all forgive me if you do because I don't. But I think about the ventricles being the big guys on the team. I don't know if that's offense or defense. I don't know who they are. I never paid attention. But the ventricles are the big guys. They're not sprinters. They're not meant to move fast. They are there to do a job, and it's to be the muscle of the heart. That's what the ventricles are supposed to do. So how well do you think they do that job when we make them go as fast as they possibly can?
No.
They don't do well. So mathematically, as heart rate goes up, cardiac output goes up because it's part of the formula. But what happens in real-life human beings is as heart rate goes up, eventually you get to a point where your heart rate is so fast that your stroke volume begins to fall because the ventricles can't move that quickly. That's not what they're built for. So even though the heart rate's going up because the stroke volume's going down, what happens in a real-life human being if our heart rate gets too fast? The cardiac output falls because it cannot maintain that way. So if y'all learned about rhythms already, right? So if you have a patient that goes into AFib with RVR and their heart rate's 160, what happens to their blood pressure? It bottoms out. Why? First of all, they've lost their atrial kick because they're in AFib. So that decreased their stroke volume because it decreased the loading of their heart. And secondly, their heart rate's 160, so their ventricles are not pumping effectively, so their stroke volume's falling. So even though mathematically a heart rate of 160 would increase cardiac output, we know that once we get that high, it starts to fall down, okay? So the three things that make cardiac output are your preload, your contractility, and your afterload. Preload, yes, ma'am?
I'm sorry, I couldn't tell
Do I still have Mackinish and Alexandria here? I see Mackinish.
Yes, no. Are
you?
Yeah. There's Paul here. And there's Alexandria.
Oh, okay.
It's just Patty.
Yeah, okay, let me tell them.
Miss Akins is having technology issues.
Okay, she's with everybody.
Yeah. We won't judge her for that.
Okay.
That's all right. So when we're looking at cardiac output, we have preload, afterload, and contractility, and these are not new words for you. You learned these in physiology, pathophysiology, and second level, but we're going to review them real quickly. So preload is the pressure that's filling the heart. It's the blood that's coming into the heart. Now, when you learned about this at first and second level and preclinical, you were talking about blood loading the right side of the heart, because that's this class and talk about both of those. But preload is the feeling pressure. And then you have contractility, which is the squeeze. That's how well the ventricle is actually squeezing to push blood forward. And then you have afterload, which is what we have to push against. It's the resistance that we have to push against to get blood out of the ventricle. So when we're measuring preload, which is the filling of the heart, if I'm measuring from the right side, the filling of my heart tells me, do I have enough blood? Am I bleeding out? Am I dehydrated? Which is going to affect all my hemodynamic numbers. And I measure that. Yes, ma'am. No, not Christian Alexandria over here. It's just Patty Evans.
Oh, she just didn't make sure you were
home. I already did. It's done.
Is it recording right now?
It's recording.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it?
Okay. Miss Akins is causing chaos. I apologize. If we're measuring our preload on the right side of the heart, that measurement is going to be your CVP, central venous pressure. It's when we're measuring right before the blood goes back into the right atrium of the heart, and it tells us what the filling pressure is to the right side of the heart. We also can measure a left atrial pressure, which would measure the preload of the left side of the heart, because that's the pressure in the blood right before it goes into the left ventricle. But we only can do left atrial pressures if we're in the cath lab. That's the only place that you can get that measurement. And then we also have a number that's called the wedge, or you can write PAWP, which is pulmonary artery wedge pressure. You're going to see it as PAWP, PAOP, PCWP. There's lots of ways you can abbreviate it. But it's either pulmonary artery occlusion pressure, pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, or the nurses are just gonna call it the wedge, is what they call it. But that also tells you preload to the left side of the heart. And we're gonna talk about how we get that number in a minute. So I know y'all don't know what that is. Y'all just hang with me, okay? Pulmonary artery, which one did you write down? PAOP, which abbreviation? Okay, so PAOP is pulmonary artery occlusion pressure.
Okay.
Or if you see PCWP, it's pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. Or if you're talking about it, you're just going to call it a wedge. But those are all the same thing. It's just, it depends on where you read about it. Your contractility can be affected by several things, and you already know this. If you have electrolytes that are out of whack, especially which ones? Which electrolytes cause change of contractility in your heart?
Potassium.
Sodium and calcium, and then we watch potassium and magnesium very closely too, because although they're not really the squeeze of the heart, they affect the rhythm, which can affect the squeeze of the heart, or at least your cardiac output. If they have an MI, if they've gotten old, their heart just isn't as effective as it was before, and there are medicines that we give it can also decrease the contractility of the heart. We never give a medicine and say, ooh, your heart is too strong. Let me give you this medicine to make it weaker. We never do that. But we do give medicines that decrease contractility. Can anybody tell me a class that does that? I got some clinical people in here. Y'all better answer me.
Calcium channel blockers.
Beta blockers. Thank you, Jesus. I taught her something in second level. Beta blockers. We never give beta blockers because we say people's hearts are too efficient. But we give beta blockers for other reasons. And if y'all go back today just for fun and look up the side effects of beta blockers, you're going to see all the signs and symptoms of congestive heart failure. Why? Because beta blockers decrease the contractility of the heart. So they can lead to congestive heart failure. They love having you in second level, by the way, because we talked a lot about heart. Then you also have your afterload. We can measure that. I already gave you one measurement for it. What was that? Systemic vascular resistance, so SVR, measures your afterload. But that's just on the left side of the heart, right? Because the left ventricle pumps out into the body. So if I'm measuring afterload on the right side of the heart, then we have what's called PVR, your pulmonary vascular resistance. Do you see why it's so important to know your anatomy? Because you don't know how to match up your values if you don't know how the anatomy fits together. So there's lots of things that can affect that as well. There's medications that we can give. We use a medication called Viagra for people that have pulmonary hypertension. That's not what the drug was originally made for. But what they found is that when we give Viagra without lowering their systemic blood pressure, Viagra actually causes them to dilate on their pulmonary side. So we can treat a high afterload on the right side of the heart without affecting blood pressure if we give them Viagra. So we've talked a little bit about this. I know this slide makes y'all very happy, but we've already talked about this, and this was not hard, and y'all all of us said it. I just want you to know what the science is it's based in. This is the Frank Starling curve. And what this curve is telling you is if I look at the volume that's left in the ventricle after it squeezes, before it squeezes, I'm sorry, in diastole. If I look at the blood in the heart before it squeezes, so that's filling pressure, if I see how well I'm feeling, as the volume goes up, the cardiac output and stroke volume are going to go up. Except that you see at a certain point, if I get too much volume, it levels off and then it begins to go down. And we know that because y'all call that congestive heart failure. So if our heart rate goes too fast or our volume gets too high, even though those are the things we need to make cardiac output, if we get too much of anything, it's a bad thing. Even oxygen, we're going to talk about that when we do vents. So the Frank Starling curve basically shows you that if you have a patient, this red curve here, and they are volume low, then their cardiac output and stroke volume are low. And that makes sense, right? And as you give them fluids or you give them blood, depending on what they need, as their volume moves to the right, their stroke volume increases tremendously. But at a certain point, the volume quits making a difference. And then if you keep going, it will actually start to fall because the heart will start to fail. If they have a decreased heart function because they've had an MI, they're old, whatever, you've given them beta blockers, then their volume, their stroke volume never catches up like it does the normal heart. If you have somebody that's an athlete that has great cardiac function, then their cardiac output may be higher, but they too are going to level off and start to fall at a certain point. They can handle more than the person with a sick heart, but they're still going to fall off. And I want y'all to remember what this curve looks like, because when y'all go to critical care for clinical, you're going to see this on some of the equipment. We'll talk about that in a little bit. The nursing staff may not all be able to talk to it. You'll be able to teach them about what that is on their machine if they don't know. But you're going to see this in a device that we use every single day. So here is a chart for you. And I hate to memorize things. I don't like it. But I will tell you that when we get to the end of this, we're going to have talked about all these things. You're going to have this slide again as we go through the lecture today. And you just need to memorize. You need to memorize what the normals are, and you need to know if it's high or low, what can cause those things. And we're going to answer all this as we go through, but when we get to the end, we'll have the slide again, and we'll fill it in together, okay? So your stroke volume we talked about is the amount of blood you pump out each time your heart beats, and we said 60 to 100 is normal. Some references say 60 to 70. Your stroke volume index, anytime you see an index added to a value, all that means is they took into account the size of the patient, their body surface area, and they related that stroke volume to that body surface area. So the stroke volume of a big 6 foot, 250 pound guy is not going to be the same as the stroke volume of a newborn that was 8 pounds, right? It makes really good sense that he's going to be pumping out more blood than that baby is at birth. But if you take into account body size, then normal ranges actually start becoming closer. There still is a little bit of difference. Everything I gave you was for adult because that's what this class centers on. But it gets much closer as compared to stroke volume, which is nowhere near the same. So which one's more accurate? Which one tells you more information? The stroke volume index. Index is always better. So your stroke volume index is on there as well. And then you have your stroke volume variance. The stroke volume variance tells you from beat to beat, how much does your stroke volume change? If you're beating 60 times a minute, then over the course of 15 seconds, How much is your stroke volume changing from beat to beat? What stroke volume variance is telling you is if you need some fluid. If your heartbeat, the contractility of your left ventricle is not changing dramatically from beat to beat, right? I mean, it's rough. Now, if you have a big event like an MI, then yes, it's going to rapidly decline. But unless that's what's happening, from beat to beat, your heart is about the same. So if your stroke volume is changing dramatically from beat to beat, then it's not a contractility issue. It's a volume issue. We need more volume to supply the pump so we can pump it forward. So a normal stroke volume variance is 10 to 15% because we're human, we're not machines, so it's not going to be exactly the same. If you see a stroke volume variance that's higher than that, they need volume because their heart can't stay consistent because it's pumping everything forward and grabbing everything it can to push forward, but it probably could do more if we primed it better. Cardiac output, we already talked about that. Cardiac index is your cardiac output in relationship to your body surface area. Which one's more accurate? Which one tells you more? Your cardiac index. CVP is central venous pressure, which tells us preload to what side? To the right side of your heart, that's correct. And y'all already learned about CVP because y'all did central line, so you probably have seen a central line with your CVP transduced. But if not, we're going to talk about that in a minute anyway. Then you have your PA, which is your pulmonary artery systolic and diastolic pressure. It's just like your systolic blood pressure. You have a PA, systolic, diastolic. So you're used to your blood pressures being measured in your arm, leg, whatever. It's a systemic measurement, which is measuring how well the left ventricle is doing, pumping blood out to the body. But we also have blood pressure in the pulmonary side. Y'all just have never been able to measure that before. That tells us how well the right side's doing pumping blood forward and how well the left side's doing with volume. Because if the left side of the heart starts failing, where's it going to back up into? Into the pulmonary system. Because that's how the anatomy flows. So normal PA pressures are 15 to 30 over 8 to 15. So we'll say 20 over 10 would be a beautifully perfect PA pressure. Then you have your PAOP, PCWP, wedge, whatever you want to call it, which is your pulmonary artery occlusion pressure. And we're going to talk about it, too, when we get to our PA catheter in a minute. And then you have your SVR and your PVR. SVR measures afterload of what side of the heart? Left. Very good. And PVR measures afterload of the right side of the heart. And yes, you have to know all those numbers. I'm sorry. You have an extra line? What does it say? It's supposed to be PA. I'm so sorry. It's a typo that I probably called after I sent that to her. Yours says PS diastolic. It's supposed to be PA diastolic. It may say PS. But that's pulmonary artery diastolic. So we're going to look at all these again. But I've tried to put them all in one place for you, so when you study, you have all your values right there. So they're going to be scattered throughout the lecture. We're going to come back to this at the end again, okay? So when you go to do hemodynamic monitoring on a patient to measure any of those things that we just talked about, you have got different types of monitoring. You can do non-invasive monitoring, which you have done since first level because you've been taking people's blood pressure. And we call it a NIBIT, which is a non-invasive blood pressure, because we like to make up words and make it hard for nursing students. We can't just call it a blood pressure, but we call it a NIBIT. But we also have something that we use for non-invasive called it's a bioimpedance technology, but it's called the CHINO. We're going to talk about that again in a minute. So there is more non-invasive out there than you learned about in first and second level. Then we do minimally invasive, and the reason we say minimally invasive is because we don't have to put a big PA catheter in you, but you do have to have a central line in order to have a flow track. But it gives us some values, and we're going to look at that in detail. And then we have invasive, which that's an arterial line, a central line, a PA catheter, and then an intra-aortic balloon pump. But we're going to talk about all those things. So first, with non-invasive, I refuse to talk to you about NIBITs because y'all have been doing that for quite some time. If you don't know how to take non-invasive blood pressure, then we need to talk after lecture, so y'all just let me know. But I also have a technology out there called Cheetah, and that is a name brand. It's a registered trademark, and I do not work for them, and I don't get any money. But I'm just letting you know, so if you go to clinical, there's one there, you'll understand how it works, okay? If they wanted to pay me money, I would take it, but they haven't offered yet. So Cheetah Medical made this device, and you can see that it's got these four EKG electrodes. Let me tell you, first of all, nobody comes into ICU in heart failure that looks like that. I don't know who they got to model this, but this is not what your patients are going to look like. So, ladies, I apologize, but you're going to be sorely disappointed. If a patient comes into the emergency room, or we have a rapid response on the floor, or there's a patient that's in ICU and their blood pressure is low, and the doctor or the nurses don't know, do we need to give a medicine such as Lebofen to help with their blood pressure, or do we need to give fluids because they're dry? And we don't know because we don't have all those hemodynamic values. That's where Cheetah helps us out. So you can get these four sticky pads, stick them on your patient. It requires no line. It requires no physician. They can order this from home, or there may be protocols in place for the nursing staff to do that. They connect them to this monitor, and suddenly they are given cardiac output, cardiac index, stroke volume, all the things. They're also given the ability, once they put that monitor on there, to do a passive leg raise. Y'all know what that is. The patient's laying into bed supine. We get all of our numbers to get our baseline. And then you grab their feet and you lift them up to 30 degrees. And what did we just do to this patient? Gave them a fluid bolus without an order, because we don't need one, because it was already their fluid. We just moved where it was. So we lift their legs to force all that blood to rapidly return to the heart to give them a little fluid bolus. And then we can look at their numbers to say, okay, when we gave that fluid bolus, what happened to their cardiac output? Did it go up or not? If their cardiac output goes up with that fluid bolus, which we know is just us really raising their legs, then they probably need fluid. If their cardiac output stays the same or goes down, then we're like, yeah, let's not give them fluid because they're probably not going to do well with it. Patients who are fluid overloaded who receive fluid to help with low cardiac output have like a 60% mortality. So we don't want to give fluid if it's wrong. This is a way for us to see how would they react to a fluid bolus without giving them a fluid bolus. It also gives the nurses at the bedside to do this maneuver, get some values, and the first time I'm on the phone with the doctor, I'm saying, hey, we had this patient that came in. This is what's going on with them. This is what their blood pressure was. When I put a Cheetah on them, this is my baseline. We did a passive leg raise. I see this. Can I get some volume? Well, now the doctor's not at home, freaking out, worried, should I give volume on a patient they've never seen, because they have a beautiful clinical picture of what's going to happen to this patient when we give a fluid bolus. Because I've already told them, because we have the science behind it to show them what's going to happen. So who comes in with that low blood pressure? We use this a lot on septic patients. The data that we have on septic patients right now pretty much shows that when a patient comes in septic and is hypotensive, about half of them will respond to a fluid bolus, and about half of them will probably die if you give them. That's not real good odds, right? When you're the one that's trying to decide if you're going to order volume or not. I got a 50-50 chance here that I may help them a whole lot or push them over the edge to death. So we needed some science to figure out which way we were. Flipping coins when people's lives aren't really good practices. So Cheetah's baseline that they use is that if you see a 10% increase in your cardiac output with the passive leg raise, then they recommend you give fluid. If it's not at least 10%, then we don't give the fluid. And do you know what it's doing, really? If y'all remember that Frank Starling curve, it's pushing you to the right of the curve to see where you go. If I push you right, do we go up? Do we level off? Or do we go down? So the nurses may not start talking about the Frank Starling curve if you see a Cheetah, but that is exactly the science that is used with this. Then we have minimally invasive, such as a flow track, a central line, or an arterial line. Now, I know a central line and arterial line are invasive, right? You have to stick people for that. Doctors have to do it. You have to have consents unless it's an emergency. get all that, but compared to a pulmonary artery catheter that's this long as my arm, it is less invasive than that, and that's why it's considered minimally invasive, because it's just a central line or an arterial line, as opposed to a catheter that goes through your heart all the way into your lungs, which is way more invasive. So we have the EB-1000, which is FloTrac, once again, British trademark, and once again, they give me no money. But we use them all the time, and you are going to see this quite often. Our FloTracs can tell us cardiac output, cardiac index, SVR, SVRI, which we didn't talk about, but what do you guess SVRI is? If SVR is systemic vascular resistance, it's the index. Which one's more accurate? See how smart you are already. You already get it, right? So don't freak out if you see something and you're like, oh my God, we didn't talk about that one. Stop and think about what do I know about this, okay? I know what an SVR is. We put an eye on it. I know what they did. They're looking at the size of the patient. This one is more accurate than an SVR. Or more specific, at least. Maybe accurate's the wrong word, but specific for sure. The downside to FloTrac, you have to have a central line and an arterial line to use a FloTrac. It transduces, and we'll talk about what that means in a minute, off of the central line of the arterial line to give you the numbers for the FloTrac. And that's why those are stuck under there for you to remember that. So I can't just go in as a nurse on a fresh admit that the doctor hasn't gotten through yet and put a FloTrac on them and see what my numbers are. I can do that with the Cheetah because it just takes the four stickies. But with this one, I have to have a doctor, I have to have a line, and I have to have it transduced, which means hooking it to electricity, but we'll talk about that in a minute, for me to get these numbers. The other downside to this is that it's supposed to be, it's only by the company deemed to be accurate on ventilated patients that are not having any spontaneous respirations. And I'll tell you, that's not most of our patients. Most of our patients, even that are ventilated, are breathing over the vent. We put it on them, we use it on them, but we know that the accuracy is diminished if they are spontaneously breathing, on or off the vent. Have you been in clinical yet? Oh, I was going to say, you're going to see them hooked up to people all the time that are breathing over. But I need y'all to understand, it compares to a PA catheter, which is the gold standard for accuracy, on a ventilated patient that's not breathing over. So if you hear a CV surgeon or somebody going, I don't believe that, we're putting a swan in them, that's why. Because we know that the accuracy is less if they're breathing over or if they're not on the vent. Y'all see anything on this picture that you recognize? What's that?
Someone has a question.
Curve. She's also smart, right? And the brainstorming curve tells me, as I get more volume, this is what happens to my cardiac output, right? And you see that little green dot? That's where this patient is. Do we need to give them volume?
No.
What's going to happen if we give them volume? They're either going to maintain or go down, and we don't want that. Why give somebody volume if it's not going to help us? So this little green dot is telling me I don't need to give volume to this patient. If that little green dot was way down there, then I could give some volume and help. But look at the other number that it's giving you. What's SVV?
Stroke volume.
Stroke volume variance. And we give volume if the stroke volume variance is? So the bigger the number, the more likely they are to respond to volume. And look at what their stroke volume variance is. Do we need to give volume? No. Now you know where we are on the curve. You understand how those two things work together.
Oh, very smart.
Very smart people. So we use FloTrac a lot. I will tell you that most of the time, we use FloTrac at my facility on patients that are septic, not necessarily surgical patients as often. If we have a heart, a cabbage that rolls out, we're going to do that lecture later this semester, but if we have a cabbage that rolls out that they have a FloTrac on, it's because they couldn't get a swan in them. They tried. I can promise you. But they couldn't get it in, and this is the next best thing. And for right then, when they roll out of surgery, when they still are anesthetized, because we don't reverse that, they're not breathing over, they're on the vent, it gives us accurate numbers. But tomorrow, if we get into trouble, and the patient's now on pressure support, I don't know what that means yet, but we'll talk about it, where they're doing all the breathing, if we know it's not as accurate. So the CV surgeons get all twirled about it, because they don't know how much of the accuracy they've lost.
Miss Andrea has a question.
I'm sorry, I can hear somebody, but I can't hear what you're saying. Do we have a question?
Okay, what was your question?
It's not accurate. Why do we use it?
She said if the, which one was that? The flow track. If the flow track is not accurate, why do we still have to use that?
Because having data that's not 100% accurate is better than not knowing at all.
Yeah.
And unless, now, I will tell you that there are times, and we encourage all the students, when you go in to take care of your patient, don't treat the monitor, treat your patient. And if your flow track says that your cardiac output is 2 liters a minute, and your patient is pink and warm and has a great blood pressure, something's wrong. That's not right. We all know that. But if your patient looks like the numbers, then it's probably accurate enough that we can base which way we're going to go. And it does, it's better to have some information than to not have any at all, as long as it matches with our clinical picture. But that's why, as we get to this invasive stuff, because it is way more invasive, that's why for some patients, they choose to go all the way to that and not use the less invasive, because we know it has limitations. So if we're doing invasive monitoring, and this doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if I have a triple lumen catheter in my IJ that I'm transducing for a CVP. It doesn't matter if I have an arterial line that's in an artery to measure blood pressure. It doesn't matter if I have a PA catheter that we're going to talk about in a minute that has a bunch of ports off of it. Whatever it is, you have to have these pieces. So starting up here, you're going to have a pressure bag. This is not what they look like, okay? This is the only picture I could find that you can see all the pieces. This is ugly. It doesn't look like this. Our pressure bags, you see this little thing that's coming off right here, and y'all know when you put the turkey in the oven, the little thing pops out and says, done! That's what our pressure bags kind of look like. It has like a tower gauge looking thing off the side of it, and as you pump up the pressure, that little tower gauge starts coming out, and when it gets to green, you stop, and if it gets to red, you went too far. But you're going to blow up this pressure bag, however they measure it, to keep pressure on this bag of solution, which is probably going to be normal saline. Most facilities use normal saline. I'm an old enough nurse that I've been around long enough that I remember when we put a heparin solution in all of these, but then we figured out, not me, but somebody smarter than me figured out, that exposing all these patients to heparin made it much more likely that they had an adverse reaction to heparin that's hit. So we quit doing that. Unless a patient needs heparin, we don't give it to them. So we just use saline now in most cases. But you follow your facility policy, whatever that is. So you're going to have your bag here, and this is going to be pumped up high enough that it maintains pressure. Because if you think about it, if this is going into an artery, I've got to have higher pressure in this bag than is in that artery to keep blood from backing up into the tubing. And even if it is a venous line, I still have to have pressure or blood's going to back up. Because it could if I didn't have pressure behind it. So it comes on down, and you do see that it has a drip chamber there, and that's just like we have on regular IV tubing, because it is going to push about 3 cc's an hour from that pressure through that tubing into whatever line that is to keep it patent. You do not have to record that on intake. They drool more than that, okay? But it is giving them about 3 cc's an hour to keep the line open. And then you come on down, they have a roller clamp here, which should be open, because if you close it off, then your line is going to clot off because we've stopped the forward flow of the fluid. And we come on down, and you have here what's called a transducer. And once again, this is not what ours look like. This is how you know you've found a transducer. You have got liquid, in this case it's saline, that's in this tubing, meeting up with electricity that's plugging in to a monitor. Now, I know that sounds scary, but liquid and electricity are touching. But they're not really touching, but it's taking the movement of that liquid to turn it into a waveform that's up here. And this is our waveform. So somebody way smarter than me figured out how to look at this liquid as it's going by and turn that into a waveform that we can measure and look at the actual waveform to see if it's doing what it's supposed to do. Now, what that waveform looks like is going to be different depending on what we're measuring. An arterial line is going to look very different than CVP because an arterial line is pulsatile because we're measuring arterial pressures, right? Whereas CVP, kind of, you're going to see a little hump in it, but it's definitely not pulsatile. I don't like this pressure because that looks like it's pulsatile, and it's really not. So you're going to find your CVP. And then you go on through, there's going to be some three-way stopcocks on here, and three-way stopcocks can get very important on pressure lines, especially if it's an arterial line, because if you turn that the wrong way, you're going to be squirting blood across the room. because this is arterial pressure blood. You don't want that to happen. Blood squirting around across the room is never good, okay? And then it goes into something. It can go into a central line. It can go into an arterial line. It can go into a PA catheter. It can go into a balloon pump. But it's got to go into something. It's got to get through the skin into a place to measure the pressures there, because that's the whole purpose of the system. What pressure you measure is going to depend on where the hole is that I'm looking for it. Okay? Does this make sense? So if you hear what the nurses say, the doctor's getting an arterial line in, I'm going to go get a pressure set up. What they're talking about is this bag, this fluid, this tubing that has the transducer on it and the cable that plugs into the monitor. That's a pressure setup, because I need all of those things to set up and get ready to connect to whatever line he's putting in to give me my pressures I need. I'm going to prime all this. I'm going to have it ready. I'm going to level and zero it, which we'll talk about in just a minute. And I'm going to be standing there with it in my hand so that when the doctor gets the line in, we can just connect it, and then I have this beautiful waveform, hopefully, on the monitor that gives me lots of information. So the first one we're going to talk about is an arterial line. Arterial lines can be put in radial, brachial, or femoral. You actually can also have one in a couple other places, but I've only ever seen one. I had a patient one time with a pedal arterial line. That freaked me out a little bit, but they had cerebral palsy and they were contracted and they could not get to any other pulse point to put an arterial line in. So there are some other places. They can do a cut down and do an axillary, but I've never seen that. These are the places that you see arterial lines. Your number one choice is always going to be radial. It's clean. It's easy to get to. If you have a patient that comes out of surgery that has a brachial arterial line, if you look down at that same arm, you're going to see multiple places where they tried to get it radial and they couldn't. And so because of whatever reason, anatomy, they have bed vascular or whatever, they'll move up into brachial if they have to, but if they didn't go there first. They didn't want it brachial. They went there because they couldn't get it radial. And then if you have a patient that codes that is totally unresponsive and in a code situation, they're dropping lines real quick, they'll do femoral sometimes because they can put a triple lumen and an art line right there next to each other, lay them in side by side, and you have your monitoring and your access all together. But we know, what do we know about femoral? It's gross, right? It's dirty, especially for people that are pooping and in the bed, and so they have a much higher infection rate than other sites. So we try not to put them there. It also limits mobility, because truth be known, patients should be getting up and walking down the hallway when they have a femoral line in, because it's long and it's in that vessel and they're moving it, and it actually can cause damage to the inside of that vessel. We don't want that either. I'm not going to say you never see it, but we don't like it. A radial line, they get up and jog up and down the hall when they're ready. It's less risk of infection. It's easy to get to. Most people with radial, with art lines aren't jogging, but if they wanted to and were able, they could. At that point, we need to be decided if we need to take the line out, but we could. And the reason we put it in is because it gives us a continuous readout of systolic and diastolic mean arterial pressure, and it gives us a place to draw blood out of. So we can get an arterial sample anytime we need to without sticking the patient. So if we have a patient that's on the ventilator doing really bad and we're having to draw ABGs very frequently, they may decide to put an art line in, even if they're hemodynamically stable, because they can get an ABG very quickly and know that it's accurate, because if y'all have ever seen them stick an ABG before on somebody, it's hard to get. When we get it out, especially if they're having respiratory difficulty, we don't know if we got a bad sample or their breathing is that bad. We know this is arterial. So the patients who put these on, or put these in, the doctors put these in, are either hemodynamically unstable, they're on pressors, they've got frequent blood draws for some reason, or they have some sort of cardiovascular or other really large surgery. We have patients that, like our carotid endarterectomies, when they come out, every one of them have an art line, because we know there's a high risk of them getting hemodynamically unstable, even though the surgery itself is relatively short, and they usually spend one night and go home. But they all come out with an art line because of the high risk of them being hemodynamically unstable. So this is what it looks like. So when y'all go into ICU, now this is obviously a video that's only about 4 seconds long, so your monitor should not be jumping around like that. But what you're going to see is that you have your EKG up here, and they move around or something. Right here, you're going to see like some trash because they move around. You have your arterial line that's going across here, and you're going to see for every beat, you have a pump on your art line right behind it, because every time your heart depolarizes, your ventricles squeeze, it makes a pulse, and that's what you're seeing is their pulse. The readout on their ART line tells you that their blood pressure is roughly 102 over 53 with a MAP of 73 to 4. But you see it's changing all the time, and that's pretty normal. It's probably not changing big, but it is moving all the time because it's constantly giving you a readout of what their blood pressure is. Now down here, we have another waveform. This is from our pulmonary artery catheter, and it's given our pulmonary artery systolic, diastolic, and mean. This is not your wedge. This is your mean. We have to do something else to get a wedge, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And then we have our CVP, which you see, it's not pulsatile, but you can see a little bit of movement. And these are very typical colors. These colors mean something, and they're pretty universal, though it's not written anywhere. We usually transduce and label an arterial pressure as red on the monitor because that's what we're used to seeing, and it makes sense. Yellow is PA because a PA catheter is big and long and yellow. And then blue is CVP, which makes sense because the venous side is blue and the arterial side is red. So when our heart roll out of surgery and they've got all this stuff hanging from them and you're just connecting stuff, if the nurse that's plugging stuff in plugs it in, looks at the monitor, and they're like, oh no, that's an ART line, they can just change it if it's the cord that they had originally told the monitor was the PA or the CVP. So you have to know what your waveforms look like so you can make sure you set your monitor at pressure, because the monitor doesn't know what you're plugging it into. It just reads whatever's on the other end of the line you plug it into. So you can transduce an ART line and have it show up as a CVP on the monitor and it give you one number and be blue, but the waveform's going to look like this. And if that happens, then you've messed up. You need to fix it. We also have received a patient before that was an admit to our hospital from another outlying facility that will remain nameless. They were sicker than snot. They airlifted them to us. They got to us. The patient had a femoral triple lumen. And the doctor was there. We had no idea what the clue status was or any of that. We hadn't gotten a lot of great information and report. And so the doctor said, hey, I want y'all to transduce a CVP on that femoral triple lumen. Okay, so what's your first thought? My purpose is to get a central venous pressure. Am I going to get one from a femoral line? No. Is this going to be accurate? Not really. Does it give him a ballpark? Yeah, kind of. So we did have to do the double take, like, it's a femoral line. Like, I know, but give me something to go with, because he was just trying to get something. We hooked up our femoral triple lumen, transduced the distal port, because that's what you would transduce to get your CVP, had it labeled CVP on the monitor. It was blue. It said CVP. It gave me one number, and my one number was 84, and my waveform looked like this. And everybody in the room went, well, crap. Where's that triple lumen? In their femoral artery. I want to reiterate that we did not do this. We received this. But it was in their femoral artery. When the doctor placed it, he got the wrong vessel. So immediately, we're like, oh my gosh, what else go into this? Well, they have been infusing three pressors to this line into a femoral artery. I don't know for how long. I don't remember on this patient. So what if we had three pressors going? Pressors all are making that vessel clamp down. And then what do? We pulled back the covers, and sure enough, what color do you think his foot was?
Blue.
Because we're giving very potent meds. I say we. We did it very short term. But we're giving very potent medications into an artery that's causing that artery clamp down. We've just cut off the supply to that leg. And he wasn't really responding to the pressors because they weren't getting anywhere. They were just in his left leg. So you have to look at your waveforms. It's just not a matter of I connected it to the line, because your waveforms tell you if it looks like it should based on where it's supposed to be. So we immediately put in a central line in another location, moved our CVP over to that, and transduced his triple lumen for a minute for a blood pressure, and then they wired over an arterial line. They changed out the line but kept the site because we had a great arterial line access. We just had the wrong line in it. Okay, so this is what an arterial line waveform should look like. Here is my systolic blood pressure. Here is my diastolic blood pressure, which makes sense because it comes up and it starts to go down, and then there it ends. That's the lowest point. So I want y'all to think about it again. We're the red blood cells. We're in the left ventricle. The ventricle squeezes. We all run out that door and create a The valve. What valve am I running through? Aortic valve. So this, if this is an arterial line, which is systemic blood pressure, this is called the dicrotic notch. And the reason is because it is a notch that splits this waveform into two pieces. So dicrotic notch. And it is the closure of the aortic valve. And you see that the pressure is falling much more rapidly before the valve closes than afterwards. So what's happening is the ventricle squeezes. We all run out the door. We have this rapid increase in blood pressure. And then the ventricle relaxes and the blood pressure starts to fall. And right before it gets to an equilibrium, those doors close to keep blood from flowing back into the ventricle. And then it just naturally falls off here until the ventricle squeezes again. It's going to be important, too, when we talk about balloon pumps. But this is what the arterial line looks like, and this is the dicrotic notch. And that's if that's an arterial line that's in your wrist, your brachial, your femoral. What if this was an arterial line waveform from a PA catheter, from your pulmonary artery? Would it still look like this? Absolutely, because it's still an arterial waveform. Would it still have a dicrotic notch? Absolutely. What valve would make that dicrotic notch? It's not the aortic. It's not in the pulmonary. The pulmonic valve is what makes the dicrotic notch in a pulmonary artery waveform. So it depends on what side we're looking at. So this gives us a direct readout of what our patient's blood pressure is. So is it always accurate? We can do all kinds of things to mess this up, okay? If that transducer, if you remember on this picture here, see where this transducer is? Depending on what kind of, depending on what you're transducing, that transducer has to be in a certain place. But for everything we're talking about today, that transducer has to be level with the phlebostatic axis of the heart. And the phlebostatic axis of the heart is, we'll look at a picture in a minute, mid-axillary here, and is that about the nipple line, or where the nipple line should be? If you have an 80-year-old lady, it's not at her nipple line. It's where her nipple line starts, okay? But you see that their transducer is correct, because if I make this plus mark, this is where my spot is, and it is level with that. If I take that transducer and drop it down on the floor, then it's going to read very much higher than is real, because now it's adding gravity in all that movement of that fluid. If I raise it up above their head, it's going to give me a false blood pressure because if the patient has a big clot on the end of their line, then it's going to give me a false blood pressure because it can't move like it wants to. But we have to start watching our waveform and see if our waveform looks like it's supposed to. So don't assume because you have an arterial line that it's accurate. So one of the things that you're going to do when you go in and assess your patient, when you get there in the morning, if they have an arterial line, is you're going to do a NIVET. And see if their NIVET correlates to their arterial line. And it depends on policy, but we usually say that it should be within 10. And if it's within 10, then that's close enough, and we can use our arterial line for our blood pressures. If it's not, then there are some fancy things we can do on the monitor that I'm not going to bore y'all with to try to manipulate what number our arterial line's given us, not because we don't like that blood pressure, but because we don't believe that blood pressure. So don't just go in and go, ooh, that's low. Let me see if I can make that read higher. That's not the purpose. But if our waveform is telling us something's wrong, we can manipulate it to try to get it closer to normal or closer to accurate. So here is a better picture of your phlebostatic axis. So this is where your right atrium is. Here is this transducer. And it's lined up with about the nipple line, mid-axillary. So right here. And if I manipulate the level of this, I'm going to manipulate what my numbers are. Because gravity's always there. Ask that 80-year-old lady. She'll tell you. This is what our transducers really look like. Now, there's a couple of different ones in this area because I've seen them from all the hospitals, but roughly this is what you're going to see with the transducer. So there's two things that you have to do to make sure that, to help make sure that your arterial line is giving you accurate readings. One of them is that you have to level it, and they're going to ask when you say, ooh, my blood pressure is really low, is it level? Some facilities are smarter than us, and they actually have transducers that are on a band that they'll connect to the patient, And that way, as the patient moves around in bed, sets their head up, lays down, does all that, the transducer moves with them. We don't. We put it on an IV pole. We chase them all day. We raise it. We lower it every time they move. And so it's great because you have a continuous readout, but the readout's only as accurate as the equipment is set up. So if your patient puts up their head of bed to eat or to get a drink or because they're just awake and they're talking to family, they're now suddenly a foot above their transducer and your blood pressure is going to start reading 180s. Don't document a blood pressure just because it rolled off. Make sure it's right, okay? So one of the things you're going to do, and you do this at the beginning of the shift and then throughout your shift, is make sure that your transducer is level. The other thing that you're going to do is zero your line. And I will tell you, we used to zero our line all the time. We don't zero near as much anymore. When you zero the line, what you're doing, you see this is a three-way stop clock. The fluid is coming in. It's going into the transducer. You see here's the electrical cord coming out of it. So this is where fluid meets electricity, right? Like they're not touching each other, but you have electrical hooked up to something with fluid in it. That's my transducer. This three-way stop clock just controls what can flow and what can be seen. So you see it says off right here. If I turn it off to the patient and I have it open to the room and open to my transducer, to my monitor, then what's going to happen to my waveform? I turn off to the patient. Do I have a waveform? It's flat. It goes flat. And it should read roughly zero, right? But it's probably not going to, because atmospheric pressure changes all the time. So we used to, when we set up an ART line, and you still have to do it when you set up, and we used to, once a shift, turn this off to the patient, open this cap, and we go over to the monitor, our waveform's flat, and we say, hey, that's zero. We're tearing the scale. It's no different than when you weigh diapers and peas, and you put a diaper on there without anything in it. You put a diaper on there without anything in it to say, hey, this is my zero, and then you put one that's wet to see how much urine was in there. Well, we're saying, hey, this is my zero. This is atmospheric pressure, which we know changes all the time. And then we put the cap back on, and we turn this off back here, and you're going to get your waveform back, or should. This little port right here, they all look different. Some of them have a pulley jig, and some of them have a squeezy jig. Those are not technical words. But if I pull on that blue thing right there, it's real stretchy, and it flushes. It opens the valve, and you can rapidly flush your line. And you should do that once a shift. And when you watch your waveform, what's going to happen when you pull that pulley jig and you flush it rapidly is your waveform is going to go whoop through the top and be flat. And then when you let go, it's going to go back down and then start your waveform again. Because what does the transducer see when you flush? Lots of rapidly moving, high pressure movement. And so it goes through the roof. And that's normal. You also have a place, if it's an arterial line, and that's what we're talking about, that you can pull back waste. So there's a 10cc, what they usually are, 10cc syringe-looking thing, box-looking thing, it depends on what facility you're in, that you can pull back 10cc's of blood. And then you can draw blood out of your line because you pulled your 10cc's away, so just like you did in a central line. And so after you pull your blood sample, then you can give them back their 10cc's of waste because it was all in that closed system. And then you need to flush. So you would pull this and go. So if you don't mute your alarms while you're doing all that, it's going to be screaming at you, and the nurses are going to be saying, mute that, because it'll drive you nuts. Because you don't have a good waveform, and you don't have good numbers when you have that waist pulled back while you're pulling blood, all of that. It's going to mess up your monitoring during that time, and that is perfectly okay. So here's your homework. When y'all go to clinical the first week, I want y'all to find somebody in your clinical area that has a pressure line of some type. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's an ART line, a CVP, a PA, I don't care what it is. I want you to level it. I want you to zero it. And I want you to do a square wave test on it, which is the next thing that we're going to talk about. Yes, ma'am. At our facility, you're supposed to do it once a shift. Ms. Aiken's question was, what's the current policy on correlating to cuff pressure? At our facility, we're supposed to do it once a shift, and it's supposed to be within 10. Now, follow your facility policy, but that's a very good benchmark to start with. So, to keep from opening that line up every, because we zero, we used to, because I'm old, zero a line when you set it up, because you have to start knowing what zero is. Once a shift, just to make sure that we're zero to atmospheric pressure. Anytime you disconnect the line and reconnect the line, if you go to 20, we still have to do that. Or anytime you start getting wonky numbers, if you go in there and it says your blood pressure is 50 over 30 and they're awake and talking to you and eating their Cheerios, that's probably not right. So we would re-level, we would zero, we would flush. That's just all troubleshooting you would do to say, hey, let's see if we can get this line working again. We'd look at their arm, their sight, see if it needs to be repositioned. But opening up that line that many times increases the risk of infection. And so y'all heard of central line associated bloodstream infections. They don't really relate to ART lines, but they certainly do PA catheters and central lines, which we do the same process on our CVP ports and PA ports and all of that. So to keep from doing that, we do something that's called a square wave test. And what we do is, so my waveform's going along and life is beautiful. I grab that blue pigtail and pull it out very rapidly. And what's going to happen? It rapidly flushes. And I see it go whoop way up here. And here's my flush. And then I let go. And when I let go, you should see ee. And then it goes back to my waveform. That's not technically good, but it is what it's doing, right? You go ee. Just a little noise in that waveform. And then it goes back to normal. Y'all see that? That's a beautiful square wave test. That tells me that my line is correlated like it's supposed to be. Look at this arterial line waveform. First of all, before we do our square wave test, what do you think about this waveform over here? Does that look like the example that I gave you originally? Now, when we talk about human beings, I tell you all the time, we are not machines, and we do not make machine-type things. Human beings don't usually make things that have lots of sharp corners on them, because that's not how we work. Computers do. Machines do. Human beings don't. And look at that. See how sharp that is? It's like point up. There's no gentle curves. It's very pointy. We call this whipping or under dampening. They're the same thing. And what this is telling you is that in the setup of the mechanics and the electronics of the arterial line, for some reason, we don't have a waveform that's giving us accurate information, and this is going to give us a falsely high blood pressure. It's going to read falsely high because it's either moving that catheter with the pulse and it's adding all that movement in, or for some other reason, it's not filtering like it's supposed to. So just looking at this waveform, I don't believe the blood pressure until you prove me wrong. Because this tells me it's probably going to read higher than it really is. And if you look, here's this patient's real arterial line curve. And here's their systolic blood pressure. And look at what this line's reading. It's falsely elevated. But then, I already am thinking that. I'm like, well, we're going to do a square wave test. And what's supposed to happen? I flush. I get this flat line. I let go. And it's supposed to go and go back to normal. What does it do? And then it goes back to normal. You shouldn't have that much tweaking going on, right? You shouldn't have that much oscillation going on. They call that ringing in the line, which is another way of knowing it's getting way too much feedback. It's going to give me numbers that are higher than are actually there. So you'll hear the nurses say, there's a lot of whipping in your line. Is that right? And I will tell you that sometimes when we've had a line in for a while, we sacrifice the waveform to get accuracy in our numbers. So sometimes, remember earlier, I said there's some fancy stuff we can do in the monitor to make it read and correlate with the NIVET. Sometimes the nurses have to make the waveform look like this to get numbers that correlate with the NIVET because it's reading falsely low normal. Does that make sense? Because if I make the waveform look like this, what's it doing to my blood pressure? It's raising up those numbers. So if at the beginning of the day you go in, you have a beautiful waveform, and your ART line is reading 70 over 40, and your NIVET's reading 100 over 80, you know that ART line's not right. Your nurses may make their waveform look like this to get 100 over 80 out of their ART line because they know that's what the patient's blood pressure really is. That usually we only do that when it's towards the end of life, not the patient, on the ART line, okay? So don't think, you need to question if you see this waveform and you need to go through the process. But if your nurse says it is correlating and you see that on your NIVET, and you see this ART line, I want you to understand they're not doing something wrong. They are manipulating equipment to get an accurate reading. But on a test, if you see this, your first thought should be, I need to do some assessment because I suspect that I am getting a falsely high reading. Yes, ma'am.
So you're never going to have a patient, like, truly their waveform.
can never say yes. Because we don't live in black and white. We live in gray. There are very few alwayses and nevers. Never push IV potassium, okay? Never shake a baby. We never do those things. There's very few other nevers. I mean, there are some. But when you start getting your head in, it's never going to look that way. I didn't say that. Because we don't... It is not likely. And what I would do when I walk into a room, here's the deal. As y'all are students, you've never seen it before, and you're going to walk in and go, oh, my God, look at that. She has ribbing in her waveform. She doesn't know what she's doing. And I'm telling you, that's probably not true. But when you walk in as a student, I expect you to say, they have ribbing in their waveform. I need to check a nibbit to see if it correlates because I suspect it's giving me an artificially high number. And then if your nibbit correlates, then chat with your nurse about it. Hey, there's whipping in this waveform, but it's reading accurately. And the nurse is probably going to say, yeah, it never read accurately, but if we do that, it gets the numbers we need. In which case, they're doing nothing wrong, but it's not a textbook word. Does that make sense? Okay. If I have a waveform that looks like this, do we like that waveform? What's wrong with it? Don't tell me it's over-dampened, because that's the title of the slide. I'm aware of that. But what's wrong with it? What do you know? Y'all are all shaking your head. I don't like that waveform. Huh? It does not have a diachronic notch, so it doesn't have all its pieces, and I don't like that. And it's very... I mean, I said we're rounded, but that's real rounded, right? Like, we can't even... Finding the top of that is even harder than finding the top of what a normal waveform looks like. So this waveform is over-dampened. Or they'll say it's a dampened waveform. It's going to give me a falsely low blood pressure. And what usually causes this is either that there's a clot on the end of the line, they bent their arm and the catheter's all kinked off, or you've run out of fluid in your pressure bag. Because if you don't have any pressure pushing against it and fluid moving past it, the transducer is not getting a good picture of what's going on, right? So it's going to give them a falsely low pressure. So if I'm standing at the bedside, I'm going to make sure my sight looks good. I'm going to look at my pressure bag. Is there fluid in it? Is it all pumped up? If that's all done, I'm going to aspirate to see if that moves something around. I'm going to give it back. I'm going to flush. And an aspiration and a good flush can fix this lots of times. Yes, ma'am.
Are you only going to get these right?
You made your classmates giggle. Now instead of always, it's only. Everybody behind you went, it was funny. Her question was, I can tell you this one though. Any time we're transducing a pressure line, you remember the first slide I showed you, there's supposed to be pressure going to it. There's fluid and a pressure bag going to it. So this one, I can safely say, yes, you should always have fluid and a pressure bag hooked up if we are transducing a pressure. However, because they don't live in a black and white world, if that pressure bag runs dry, you're going to get something because it's still plugged in the monitor. It's just not accurate. It's not pretty. The waveform's not pretty. And it's not giving me accurate data. Right. That's what's making our... Well, you have to have a transducer because the transducer is what's plugged into the monitor to get this. You could not have a pressure bag on it, but then... I mean, that's like saying you can eat soup without a bowl. I guess you could, but it's real hard and it's going to be ugly. You see what I'm saying? So you should never see something transduced that we're talking about without a transducer and a pressure bag. See, this is why we don't live in an always world. When y'all get to neuro, have y'all done that neuro yet, right? Y'all going to talk about EVD, which is an internal ventriculostomy dream. It has a, you're going to learn all about it. It's going to be great. EVDs are like the zebra. They're different because you don't level the transducer to the pleurostatic axis like you do with everything we've talked about here. You level it to the trachea of the ear, which is level to the foramen of Monroe in their head. So you level differently, so their transducer has to be level here. And you don't put a pressure bag on it, because I don't want to put 3 cc's of fluid in somebody's brain. So there is no pressure bag, but there still has to be a transducer, and there still has to be fluid. So we flush it with a syringe, we cap it off, and we transduce it. You cannot get this picture without a transducer. You can get it without a pressure bag. You shouldn't for any of the things we're talking about today. They're bent off, like they bend their wrist and it's clamping off the line. They have a clot on it. Their pressure bag's empty, like there's no fluid in it, or it's not blown up. If somebody forgets to turn that valve to the off position and it gradually deflates over time, it'll dampen your waveform. See, she's gonna be scared to ask a question now and think, do I have any black and white words in it? This is a very wide lecture, and it's a very wide class. And so if you're one of the, and that's what makes this class so hard for everybody, because y'all want the rules, and you want to know what the right answer is so that you can select it on the test. And I could write a question and put four answers up there and tell you what the right answer was and change those answers and make it be wrong. It's very abstract. It's hard stuff. I'm sorry. I don't know why they made me come teach the hard stuff. Because they didn't want to teach the hard stuff. Is that good?
Didn't change the answer.
I tried to tell them back to her and she didn't fall for it. So nursing care. We have somebody that's going to have an arterial line inserted. It's not really our responsibility unless we're the ones putting the art line in. It is within a nurse's scope of practice to insert an art line if you have received specialized training and you are working under a physician that is overseeing you. And by that, I don't mean like they are physically overseeing you enter this line. I mean like they're in the general area and you are working with them. So we have RNs that work in our holding area in surgery that help prep the patients for surgery to put art lines in every day under the oversight of our anesthesiologists. So before they stick for the line, if they're putting it radial, they should do an Allen test. Y'all learned about that in first level, where they squeeze off radial and ulnar flow, and then they squeeze their fist, and they open it, and it's going to be white because there's no perfusion, and they let go of ulnar, and it should pink up almost immediately. What it's telling me is I have enough flow through my ulnar artery to perfuse my hand, because we know if we put a line in our radial artery, and it blocks off some of the flow. If I don't have good flow in my ulnar artery, then I'm going to lose my hand. And nobody wants that, right? You don't want that? Your patient didn't want that. So they should do an Allen test before. There's not a similar test to do for femoral. So if they're doing femoral or brachial, you're not going to see them do that. But they do it for radial. You're going to gather up all your supplies. You're going to set up your pressure bag, your fluids, and your tubing. You're going to level it. You're going to zero it. You're going to help position the patient. It depends on the doctor how they want to position. You may have a pillow under their arm. They may have their hand taped down and hyperextended so that they can get to that site very easily. We have arm boards we can put them on to help position them. If they're femoral, of course, they need to be supine, because if they have any bend in their hip, it makes it harder to get to that site. You're going to set all your alarms. Here's your never. You should never shake a baby. That's not it. You should never have a pressure line transduced without alarms on it. Never. Because even if the values it's giving you are not accurate, they are telling you that the patient's not bleeding out in the bed. And if that three-way stopcock is turned the wrong way and your patient starts to bleed out into the bed, the only way you know that is because your alarms are ringing. Because you are not staring at that patient for 12 hours without looking away. Even if the patient said what I wanted, you're sitting at the bedside, you're documenting, you're talking to people that come to the door, you're going to the bathroom, you're allowed to do all those things, and that's why we have alarms that watch all the time. So if your art line is reading falsely low and it's giving you a blood pressure 80 over 60 and there's nothing we can do to fix it, but it's still drawing blood well, so we leave it in so we can pull blood out of it, you still set your alarms. You set them based on what your art line is reading. You don't document those blood pressures. You know they're not right, but you set your alarm so that if the line gets pulled out, if it gets turned and they're bleeding out, that something alarms to tell you to come rescue this patient. For maintenance of these lines, you're going to monitor the site. We're looking for infection. We're making sure that it's secured, that the dressing looks great. If a nurse didn't put it in, the art line's probably going to be sutured into place. But RNs, although we have the scope of practice to insert an art line, we cannot suture. It's not in our scope of practice. And so they put, kind of like on PICC lines, they'll put a securement device to hold it in place because we can't do a suture. We're going to level it, we're going to zero it, we're going to square wave test and to make sure that it's doing what it's supposed to. and that tells us that it should be accurate, but then we're going to verify with a NIBET to our arterial line, and you should do that every shift, or if your numbers get wonky and you don't believe them. You're going to use it to obtain blood samples, and you're going to have your alarms set, because you never maintain a line without having alarms turned on. And I'm going to tell you now, you're going to find somebody who has their alarms turned off because it doesn't correlate, and I preach until my face is blue about why that is unsafe. But you know when they'll believe me? When they walk in and they have a bed full of blood, and the patient's called out because they feel dizzy, and they find out that that art line wasn't correlating, and you got pulled out on accident, the patient's been bleeding in the bed for however long, and they didn't realize it. When you go to remove an art line, we can all do this. All RNs can pull art lines out. You're going to remove the suture or the device that they're holding it in place with if there's not a suture. Anytime you're pulling a line out, you want to pull 10 cc's of blood out through that line to waste before you pull it out, because if there is a clot on the end of it, we're going to suck that clot back up into the line. So you're going to pull back 10 cc's of blood for waste, pull out the line, hold manual pressure, and I will encourage you to get a chair fall out, because you're going to be sitting there for a little bit. It's an arterial line. It's high pressure. It takes a while to clot off, and you should be sitting there holding manual pressure until hemostasis is maintained. Once it's maintained, then we put a pressure dressing on it. They usually wrap Perlex around it or something to hold pressure on that site. And then I usually tell my patient, I don't know if it's in your book, but I usually tell my patient when I get up, as you move around, eating your tray, whatever you're doing, the first time you get out of bed, if you see blood on this dressing, more than what you see right now, because there's sometimes there's a little spot, you get me to come look at this. Because you don't want them to get a big old hematoma or be bleeding and you don't know about it. We also can have a simple line to transduce a CVP. Our preferred site for transducing a CVP is IJ. It has the lowest infection rate. And it's easier to get to it than subclavian, because subclavian, although you can get to it easily, you have a risk of getting a pneumothorax. And so doctors don't really like to stick there. They will if they have to, but they would prefer to go IJ, because if they miss, you can pinch your carotid, that's bad. But they don't drop a lung if they're here in the neck. You're going to see some femoral lines, with really all the evidence out there says we should avoid those because of the high risk of infection. But if they're in a code, they're probably going to do it because it's easy to put a triple M and art line together. Y'all hang on just a second. This is Denise. Okay. They've called me six times, and so I'm ignoring it, but when they call that many times, I'm worried about what's going on. If you're going to transduce a CVP, we always transduce the distal port, and the reason being is that if you're looking at a triple lumen, you have proximal-medial distal, and distal is the one that opens at the very end of the line, which gets us as close to the left ventricle, I mean the right ventricle as we can, so it gives us the most central venous pressure. If it's all taped down and you can't tell which one which, remember, distal is dirty. It's the brownish-reddish one. Distal is dirty. That's the one you want to transduce. And you can see here, if I were going to transduce, I'd transduce this one right here. That's my distal port. It also says distal right here, but sometimes depending on what the dressing looks like, you can't get to that. If the distal port's clotted off, you can transduce one of the other ones. It's kind of like the flow track. Getting information is good. We know the distal is the closest. We would prefer it if we could, but we can transduce any of them. I wouldn't choose to run IVs through my distal, though, and transduce the proximal instead, because it would be better to transduce the distal. You should be able to get here. You may not be able to get to where you can read it. So that's why it's good to know the brown one is the distal one, because then you don't have to break down a dressing to figure out which port is which. This would not be on the test. But proximal is pure, medial is Mediterranean, distal is dirty. That's how you can remember which one's which. That's not testable material. That is just, if you can't get to the thing to read it, that's how you can remember which one's which. Don't write a test question about that in a second. So who would we transduce to central, a CVP in? Someone who's fluid overloaded and we need to see how bad it is. Someone who is hypotensive and we think they need fluid resuscitation, but we're not sure if it's a pump problem or a fluid problem. If their CVP is low, they need volume. If their CVP is high, they're fluid overloaded. I will tell you I'll have to look at my chart and see what I told you your normal was. 2 to 5-ish is normal on CVP, which means that you don't have a lot of room for being low. If normal is 2 to 5, right? 3 to 5, somewhere there. I'll see what we put on your chart. We'll go with the numbers on your chart. Because every reference you look up will give you a different range of numbers. So don't get hung up on the specifics. Know generally what those numbers are supposed to be. But we have patients that roll out of a cabbage all the time that their CVP is 12, and the students will go, oh my God, they're fluid overloaded. They are not. They have a huge heart, they've had congestive heart failure, now they've had a cabbage, and if we don't give them volume to prime that middle heart, they're gonna have no blood pressure. So once again, remember when you're looking at these hemodynamics, look at your patient to see, before I diuree somebody with a CVP of 12, look at the rest of your patient. If they're not swollen, they're peeing, they just came out of a cabbage, and their blood pressure looks great, they don't need to be diureased. They're weaning off the vent, their x-ray's clear, there is no other indicator that the patient's fluid overloaded. So don't jump on a number and die on that hill if you haven't looked at the rest of your patient. Another thing too I'll tell you is don't look at trends of your values, not a single value. Don't make a big decision about the care of your patient based on a single value. I'm going to tell you a story, y'all. I'm going to be an idiot. I graduated from Northwestern. I wanted to be a super nurse. I wanted to be the best there was. I was very diligent. I wanted to do everything right. I had a patient that, my first liver transplant that I ever had that was just mine. I was off of orientation. It was my patient. Liver transplants were a one-on-one. Back then it was for 48 hours. Now it's for 24 because they're more stable now as time moves forward. But I got this patient out of the OR. The surgeons always come out before the patient comes out. And the surgeon came out and said, we're going to keep this guy sedated overnight. We're not going to let him wake up, which that's very weird. I should have known then that something was up because we don't normally do that. And he said, let me know if you have any problems. They're probably going to need some blood. But that was not weird. Livers always bleed. And so they always get blood. That was not a big deal. But the patient rolled out, already had propofol hanging. That's weird. We don't normally sedate them. Normally with our liver transplants, they do anesthesia. They put the new liver in. How do you get rid of anesthesia? Your liver metabolizes it. So when they roll out, they don't reverse anything, but we don't give them anything else. And if they start to wake up, we're like, ah, the liver's working. That's one of our indicators that the transplant's doing well. But on this patient, we hung sedation. Come find out, when they were walking this liver from the back table to the table, it broke. One side of it broke. So neither piece was big enough to be big enough for this patient. This was years ago, and this patient did fine. I need to tell you this. Neither piece was large enough to be a liver for this patient, because you have to have one big enough for the patient's size. And you can't really sew livers back together. Like, you can sew on a heart, you can sew on a kidney. The liver tissue, if they try to sew on it, the suture just pulls through the tissue. You can't sew on a liver. You can sew on the vessels, but not the liver so much. So they set both of those by each other and transplanted this patient because they had already pulled their liver out and put it in formaldehyde or whatever they put it in. I don't know. And so they put this liver in this patient knowing that it had a little crack in it. And so with time, that little crack would heal itself, but we could not do something to speed that up. So I'm in there taking care of my patient, got my propofol running, life's good, I've given a bath, I've brushed his hair, I have done all the things because I want to be the nurse. And I look up at my waveform, remember what all those waveforms look like going across the monitor, and I look up and I thought, my art line's nipping. Why's my art line nipping? What would you check? I knew he wasn't moving, because he hadn't moved at all. So I knew it wasn't my sight, but I looked at it. I checked my pressure bag, it's blown up, I still have fluid in it. I flushed it, because that's what I was taught in nursing school. I was like, it might have clot on it. It's a liver. A liver can't hardly clot to save their life. And it's a brand new line. So I wouldn't think it would be clotted, but all this stuff is going through my head, and I'm thinking about all the lecture I received in school. And then I look, and I'm like, well, now my PA catheter's dampened. And my CVP is flat. I thought my monitor was broke. And then I was like, hey, and I called out for help, and one of the nurses came in who had way more experience than I did, and she looked up there and she said, what's going on? And I flipped the covers back. Livers at that time came back with 3 JP drains, every one of them, and I can tell you where the 3 are. They don't do it that way anymore, though. And all of my JP drains were full of bright red blood. Full. And I was like, ooh, I just did Drain's clot off. So I opened up my JP Drain, and I squeezed it into the cup, and when I let go, blood kept coming. Like, you didn't have to squeeze it. It came out all by itself. That's not normal. So as he bled, I got pale, because I was like, I was just standing there holding it, and the cup was about to overflow. She's like, clamp that off. So we clamped off the JP Drain and did not empty them, because we were just insanguinating my patient into cups, is what we were doing. So I called the surgeon. He came in. The patient did not have to go back to surgery. We drew some blood. We gave lots of blood. The patient was very busy that night. I needed therapy or alcohol or both. I'm not sure. In hindsight, had I not been a brand new nurse who was thinking through lecture and was thinking about what was going on, what was my first indicator that my patient had a hemodynamic change? All of my waveform standards. Now, I am not saying it is wrong to check your bag, check your site. I'm not saying that. But when I went through my troubleshooting steps, I was like, well, that's all it was. They gave us three things. It was on the list. That was all three of them. So I don't know what to do now. It was my patient. And so if you're wondering why I preach all the time, don't nurse the monitor, nurse the patient. It's because if it wasn't for my coworkers, who were much better nurses than I was, that patient might have died, because it took me a long time to get there. So if you're having trouble with your equipment, if you're having trouble with your monitors, check on your patient. Make sure they're okay, and then we can go back to troubleshooting the monitor, okay? Then we have what's called a PA catheter, pulmonary artery catheter, and we're going to look at a picture of one in a minute. This is it. So who would we put a PA catheter in? Someone who's had CV surgery, and I've already told you, they kind of swung both ways on this with the literature. It used to be that everybody got a PA catheter that went for CV surgery, and then some literature came out that said that's a very invasive procedure, and we have some other technology we could use, and it probably would be better to decrease infection if we went with a less invasive method like the FloTrac. Our CV surgery said, nope, we don't have a problem, we don't have an infection rate. I mean, they have one, everybody has an infection rate, but ours was great. We don't trust it. We're doing PA catheters. And you know what's happened? They dug their heels in. We did not change our practice. We were watching our outcomes. They were good. And now the literature swung back the other way and said, you know what? We're just kidding. We should do a PA catheter. It's more accurate and it's the gold standard. And if anybody who needs one, it's probably CV surgery. So now, if you meet any of our CV surgeons, you'll recognize them because their heads are this big, because they were like, we told you so. And so that is what we do. It depends on the facility, how they do it. But we do about 600 parts a year. And that is what we do, is we put one in every one. If they have heart failure and we need the numbers, if we're working them up for a heart transplant, a bad workup, or they've had a huge MI, then we know hemodynamically they have changed, and this is how we get our numbers to know how to treat them. So this is what a PA catheter looks like. Yes, ma'am. That also, Dr. Bickett does that as well. It's just not most of them, but you are absolutely right. And Dr. Bickett actually has patients that come in outpatient, will come into the cath lab as an outpatient, have a pulmonary artery catheter put in so he can get all the values he needs. And based on what he finds, he may leave it in and send them to ICU, or he may pull it and send them home. It just depends. So if they're on home inotropes, like people are on home on dobutamine and Primacor now with a pump, it's craziness. But they will come in frequently, have it done, or if they're working about foreign medicine for pulmonary hypertension that's not Viagra, the medicines are so expensive that the insurance companies require that we have this information before they pay for the medicine. So you will see that also. We do that also. It's just that there's a lot more of them that do it for the other reasons. I didn't go there, but she is absolutely right. So this is a PA catheter. You see what color it is? Yellow. And so our waveform on the monitor is typically yellow. And as a matter of fact, we have a transducer that has three channels on it, and it has a red, a yellow, and a blue channel. Red one for your ART line, yellow for your PA, blue for your CVP, and you can use all three of those to plug your patient in, and it's like plug and play. It's like a new game on your computer. It's all set there and ready for you with one pressure bag set up that primes all three of those, which decreases all that stuff that's going on at the bedside. We call it spaghetti syndrome. When all of that stuff gets all tangled up at the bedside, we know that increases the risk of an error. And so we do some things to try to streamline what that looks like. So this PA catheter is yellow, and you're going to see there's a lot of stuff hanging off the end of it. So we're just going to do these one by one, okay? The first thing you see is this red port here. What does red mean if you're driving?
Stop.
Stop. I want you to remember that. Red means stop. Because you never, you're going to like this part, you never hook a syringe up to this red port and put anything in it except for the syringe that comes in the kit. This port connects to a balloon that's on the other end of the catheter. And the only thing that ever goes in that balloon is air. So there is a 3cc syringe that comes in the kit with the catheter that only allows you to pull 1.5cc's up into the 3cc syringe. It's got a little bubble on it, and it prevents you from going past 1.5cc's. So if we want to wedge the patient, we take that 3cc syringe, we pull it back to 1.5, we put it on here, and do you see how this has a red arrow on it? This little thing right here slides back and forth, and that's how you clamp and unclamp this port. And if I want to wedge the patient, and we're going to talk about what that means in a minute, then I put only that syringe on it, and I slowly inflate with however much air it takes to wedge the patient, get my reading, and then I let it loose. I never leave it in there. The red port should put a little bit of fear in you, not so scared that you're afraid to touch it. But if we inflate that and leave it, then we just made a pulmonary embolus in this patient, and they can die from that. So we don't want to do that. And we never put medicine or anything in here, because if we do, it's going to rupture the balloon on the other end, and that's bad. Anything rupturing in patients is also bad. So there's a reason why it's red. You also will have one or two ports that come off to the side that are obviously electronic and not fluid ports. You can look at those and tell. Those plug into something with electricity and not something that's an IV pump, right? That looks different. These are both related to temperature. And that's why they're red, because red also means heat, right? So these are both related to temperature. One of them gives you a direct measurement of the patient's core temperature at all times. And the other one is used to detect temperature to heat up because of the thermistor that's on the end of it. And that's just a fancy word for some wiring that's done at the tip of the catheter. That as temperature changes going past this catheter, that's how it's measuring what the patient's cardiac output is. So we can do a manual cardiac output where we shoot cold liquid into the patient and it measures the temperature change and gives you a number to tell you what the patient's cardiac output is. But those are both related to temperature. Then you have a yellow port here that obviously goes to an IV, because that's what it looks like, right? That IV fluid should be screwed in here. If it's yellow, what do you think we're going to measure with it? What's yellow mean? PA. So this is what we're going to transduce, because this connects to the pulmonary artery part of the line, which is all the way down to the far end. And we're going to talk about what that looks like in a minute. This is really long and it's really skinny, and the only thing we use this line for is to measure their PA pressures. It is an arterial line, so are we going to put anything in it? Do we give medicines in arteries? We do not. So we're not ever going to put IV fluids to it. We're not ever going to hang a piggyback to it. We're not going to give an IV push through it because it is arterial. But we can measure a PA pressure here because it's in the pulmonary artery. And if your doctor ever asks for a mixed venous gas, which is trying to tell you how much oxygen is left in the blood right before it goes back into the lungs, this gives us the most accurate representation of that. This is the furthest place down into the lungs right before it gets oxygenated that we can measure. So you can pull a blood sample out of this only for that test. Because what do you think the chances are that this port will clot off with it being that long and skinny? Has a really high chance. So the only time we would draw blood from this is if they're doing this test, because it's the only way to measure it. We have another obviously electronic cable under here that we plug in that can measure continuous oximetry. Every PA catheter may not have that, but it might. And then we have a blue port over here, and blue is CVP. So this is actually the port that we would transduce and get the CVP because of where the other end is. So this big, long PA catheter has a hole at the very end of it. That's going to be in the pulmonary artery. But if you back up, there's a hole in the side of the catheter, and it's sitting right there in the right atrium or right there in the superior vena cava, and it will give us a CVP reading just like a triple M will. Because that's where it's looking at. That's where the other end of it is. So you can see very easily if you're tracing pressure setups from a transducer over here or around three people to get it hooked up over here to a catheter that has yellow and blue, that you could get them crossed. right? Did we hurt anybody? No. But when you look at your monitor and you look at your waveforms, are you going to be able to tell you got them backwards? I hope so, or I have failed in my job. Because a CVP waveform looks very different than a pulmonary artery waveform. Now, are you going to be able to tell you got your ART line and your PA waveform separate? They look the same, but their numbers should be very different. If not, they've got a pathology. Now, I'm not saying I've never had a patient come into surgery with 100 over 80 PA pressures. It's happened, but we are doing something about that. That's not normal, and they're going to go into heart failure with that. So, if you're helping to put this catheter in, first of all, this big, long PA catheter is floppy. It would be like trying to put in a peripheral IV without a needle in it. You can't do that, right? So the first thing the doctor has to do is put in an access site. So they're going to put in what's called an introducer, and that introducer is just a central line that has a place in it that you can stick something into it. They can stick a PA catheter in, they can stick a triple lumen in, they can stick whatever they want to. Well, not whatever they want in there, but there's several different lines they can put in there. But we have to have a place to put this first, because there is no needle in this long yellow line. It's just a floppy, long yellow catheter. So we have to have something already in the vessel to pave the pathway for it. So if the doctor says, hey, we're going to put a PA catheter in at the bedside, and they might, though I will tell you most of ours are put in cath lab or surgery, but we do put one in at the bedside. You're going to gather all your supplies. You're going to need an introducer. You're going to need that whole maximum barrier kit, so you have the hats and the gowns and the drapes and all that stuff. You're going to need something to prep the site with. You're going to need your PA catheter. You're going to need to make sure that your PA catheter is smaller than your introducer, because if they're both 7 French, a 7 French catheter will not fit into a 7 French hole, right? Because they're the same size. It has to be smaller. You want to talk about frustrating a doctor? You don't want to do that. Gather all your supplies. You need your pressure bag. You need your transducer. You need to get all that set up. You're going to level it. You're going to zero it. And then you don't need to know how to do this, but there's a way that we can go in and we can turn the scales on the monitor, which makes the monitor look like this. It doesn't look like the picture I showed you while ago going across the screen. It takes up the whole screen and you've got this whole scale. It's like a graph of what your pressure line's doing. And you're ready. And the doctor's going to come in and get all ready and prep the site and put the introducer in, which is no different than a system with a central line insertion. And when they get done, they're going to open up their PA catheter. Their PA catheter comes packaged, twirled up in a circle, and they do that for a reason. It makes it smaller, but it also creates a curve in the catheter that we want to kink, because the catheter needs to go in a curve in the body. So it's actually made the catheter mold into the shape it needs to go to take the path of least resistance to get where it needs to go. They're going to lay out all their stuff, prime everything. You're going to hand off your pressure cables to them and all that, but you're not sterile, so you're not going to touch anything on the blue drape. And when they're ready, they're going to insert that PA catheter into that introducer, and then they're going to turn to you and say, balloon up. And you're going to inflate the balloon. Why? Two reasons. One, the end of that catheter is little and sharp. So if we go down and poke and poke and poke and try to make this turn with a catheter that's little and hard, it greatly increases the chance that they're going to just keep right on going this way, which would be really bad, right? So they pump it up, and it makes it kind of bounce around. It doesn't poke on things because now it's round. The other reason why is because blood is flowing this way, and what do we fill that balloon up with? Air. And what does air do in liquid? It floats. And that's why we call it floating a swan. Because we inflate that balloon, and then as he pushes the swan forward, it's floating with the flow of blood, which helps us make this turn that they have to make. So they put the catheter in. They're roughly in the right atrium, superior vena cava. We know that because we have our scales pulled up, and we see this waveform, and we're like, that's a CVP waveform, right? And we know that because central venous pressure is measured in the right atrium or the superior vena cava. And they look the same because there is no valve between the vena cava and the right atrium. So we're like, that's a CVP. I know what that is. And he may call some numbers out for you to write down because he's going to want to have these when he gets the swan in. He'll document all this. And he says, blow it up. And we put our balloon up, but our waveform does not change because it's just bouncing around in there happy, right? And then he starts pushing it forward. And your waveform is going to change dramatically because you're going to go through a valve into the ventricle, and the ventricle's waveform looks very And now it's like up, down, up, down, because it's a very pulsatile flow. And he's going to keep going, and hopefully it's going to make this turn and go back up through this valve, which is your colonic valve, into the pulmonary artery. And when you do, you see the waveform changes. And now I have this diaphragmatic notch. I didn't have one before. Why? Because there wasn't a valve closing that was causing that. I was feeling the ventricle move because I was in it. But now I'm on the other side of this valve, and now I've got a diaphragmatic notch. And this looks just like our arterial line waveform we looked at a while ago, because it is an arterial line waveform. It's just a different artery. And the balloon's still inflated. He keeps pushing it forward, and at some point, that PA catheter is going to go out far enough that that balloon wedges in that pulmonary artery, which is now preventing all forward flow of blood past it. This is why we don't do it for very long. Because what do we call it when we wedge something in the pulmonary artery and don't let blood flow forward? A pulmonary embolus. It's a man-made pulmonary embolus, but it's a pulmonary embolus none the same. So you get this waveform, which looks very different than this. And you'll go, okay, we're wedged. Deflate the balloon. You'll deflate the balloon. And what waveform are you going to get when you deflate the balloon? You're going to go back to this one. Because now the balloon's not inflated, and now I can feel that arterial flow again. And you'll say, okay, great. Inflate the balloon. And you inflate the balloon. And what waveform do you go back to? This one. Because the balloon's blocking forward flow. Now, that's a perfect world. It doesn't always happen that way. What frequently happens is they get down here and they try, they can't get it to make that curve. And what are you looking at? Your EKG. Who did EKG rhythms with you this week? Was it Ms. Akins last week? So what do you think is going to happen on your EKG if they're in there poking and prodding and tickling the inside of your ventricle? The ventricle doesn't really like that, and it starts spouting off, right? What kind of beats are you going to see?
Premature
PVCs. Because it's a place in the ventricle going, what the heck are you doing to me? Your ventricle's got a push. And so when you start poking and prodding on it, it starts spouting off these extra beats, and you're going to see PVC, or you're going to VTEC. But you know all VTEC is a bunch of PVCs holding hands, right? So PVC, or you're going to VTEC. And where's the doctor looking at what he's doing? So who's watching the EKG?
Nurse.
You are. So don't get so enthralled with watching this that nobody notices until the monitor alerts your patients immediately. You have to be his eyes, and you're going to go, having a few little PVCs, three feet run a VTAC, and he may say, okay, balloon down, deflate the balloon, and he may pull back to let the heart kind of reset, calm down, take a deep breath, and then let's try this again. Why don't we deflate our balloon before we pull back? What do you think it would do to a valve to pull a catheter through it backwards when the balloon is deflated? Nothing good, right? It would send them straight to surgery. We don't want that. So the balloon can only be inflated when we're moving forwards through valves, never when we're moving backwards. So you should always deflate the balloon before he pulls back. And if you assist the nurse doing this, you're going to hear them say when he says, balloon up, the nurse is going to go, balloon up, because it's called closed-loop communication. We want to make sure everybody's on the same page, and then he doesn't get a wild hair and start pulling the wrong way, and I've got the balloon up. Because you know whose fault that's going to be? Mine. Because nothing's ever a surgeon's fault. I don't know if y'all know anything, but that's not usually how it works. When everything goes right, it's because they're amazing. And when anything goes wrong, it's because it's our fault, even if you're not there. There's very clear communication on whether the balloon is up or down, because you can only move based on whether the balloon's up or down. So that's what you're going to see. Because it gives you our values. We put in PA catheters because we want to know what our wedge is. We want to know what our PA systolic diastolic is. We want to know what our CDP is. Those values, when we're looking, and we're about to talk about this in a minute, you're just kind of one slide ahead of me, but that's okay. That's good. I'm glad you're thinking that way. We can get a CDP from a triple illness, but we can't get our stroke volume, we can't get our cardiac output, we can't get our cardiac index, we can't get our SVR, we can't get our wedge from a triple illness. We can estimate them with the flow track, but we know that this is the gold standard. And that tells us how we need to treat our patient. If our blood pressure is low, do we need to give volume? Do we need to give a pressor that causes vasoconstriction? Do we need to give a positive inotrope that increases contractility? What's my problem? My symptom is I'm hypotensive. But what's causing it? Because there's so many pieces to that. And unless I have my numbers to look at all that, I don't know what drug you're going to fix it. So if you look at this, all of this is right side. We're measuring CBP, which is preload to the right side of the heart. But this catheter comes through, and we're looking, and I want you to think about it this way. If I were this PA catheter, and I am this eyeball at the end of the PA catheter, and I inflate the balloon behind me, and I am looking forward, because that's all I can see, because I've blocked off all the noise behind me. If I am looking forward, what am I looking at? So I'm in the pulmonary artery, and I'm looking forward, what's in front of me? The left side of the heart. And so what I'm doing is I'm out there going, hey! How's your mom and them? Mm-hmm. How you doing? Y'all doing all right over there?
Yeah.
But that, when I measure that wedge, what it's actually telling me is how is the left side of my heart doing out there? And the only way I can see that is to block up all this noise that's behind me that's coming from the right side of the heart. But the right side of the heart is a much lower pressure system. It is safer to have a catheter in the right side than in the left side. So it's kind of an indirect measurement, but it's our way of saying, hey, how's it going over there? Y'all doing all mm-hmm. right? Because if the left side is failing, and it's filling up, and pressure is moving back, what's going to happen to my wedge pressure? It's going to go up. Because the left side's not pushing it forward, so it begins to back up. So my wedge is going to go up if I'm in left-sided heart failure. Does that make sense? And we're going to talk a little more about that in a minute. So here is my introducer. This is very much what you're going to see in town. This is, I think, even the vendor that we use. This is our introducer. It's just a huge, large bore catheter. This one has a port coming off the side of it. If you have a port on your introducer, this is just like a port on a triple lumen. It's just an IV port on a venous line. That's all that is. You have to have something going to it. You can't hip lock it because it's going to clot off. So this one has a port coming off of it. If you don't have an order for fluids, then you need some TKO fluids to go to it to keep this patent. All introducers don't have a port. Some have one, some have two, some have three, some have zero. But whatever you got, you need to have something going with it, okay? If it's like this, if it's one of those big ones you got, if it's a port like this, you have to. This is our PA catheter. It's big, it's yellow, it feeds into this little hole on the top of the introducer, and then it goes down into the cerebral cava, the right atrium, the right ventricle, curves around, goes through the pulmonary artery, and it's either going to go to the left or the left or the right of the patient. So this is what it looks like. You're going to treat this site like you do every central line. When you put CHG dressings on ours, you're going to do site care, you're going to watch for infection. You're going to do all the same things you do with every other central line. You can see that this one is sutured into place. If you were pulling this out, you would have to pull these sutures out. You would pull your PA catheter before you pull your introducer. You don't pull them together. You put introducer in first, you put PA afterwards. If you pull them out, you pull PA first, and then you pull introducer. This is your transducer. Red, blue, and yellow. Now what's this? What's the right force? Your PA is yellow. You are correct. And then you have a red and a blue. One's arterial, one's venous. Which one do you think is arterial? Red. And then blue is venous. So that's my CVP. So this is one of those transducers I told you about that's all three of them going to one pressure bag just to decrease the amount of clutter you have at your bedside. This is that big 10cc syringe that I told you about that's fed into the line for an arterial line so you can pull back your 10cc's of waste. Get your sample, then give them back their 10cc's and flush. A while ago, we had a pulley jig to flush. On this one, there's no pulley jig. You see these little white handles? You squeeze them together, and that's what makes it flush. And depending on what week you are or where you are, you may see either one of those. They function the same. Yes, ma'am. They can do it. They need to have a nurse with them. And that nurse can be their instructor, or that nurse can be a nurse on the floor. Either one's fine, but yes, they can. She asked what the policy was if we could let a student discontinue us one, and we do that. I used to do it with my students all the time. Yeah, we can do that. It just you just have to have a nurse at the bedside. It's really hard to mess up. You just need to listen to your nurse that you're talking to. It's like DCing a peripheral IV. It's really hard to mess that up. You're just pulling it out. It's just you're pulling out something much longer. There are some steps you have to do. We're going to talk about that in a minute before you pull it out. So if you come in and your patient has a PA catheter and you go in to assess your patient, you're going to look at your site. You're going to look at your dressing, just like you do any central line. You're going to measure the depth of the catheter. on that PA catheter, there's skinny lines and fat lines, and it's like Roman numerals. You're gonna, if you start at the tip, the far end, you're gonna see at 10 centimeters, there's one skinny line. At 20 centimeters, there's two skinny lines. At 30 centimeters, there's three skinny lines. When you get to 50, it's a fat line. At 60, it's a fat line and a skinny line. So it's like Roman numerals. You're gonna document how deep your catheter is in. Because when they inserted the catheter, it had that beautiful place where when I inflate the balloon, I'm wedged, and when I deflate the balloon, I have a coronary artery waveform. They documented how deep the catheter was there, and we should stay roughly the same. We shouldn't be moving that thing around all the time. If you go in and the patient's, we're just gonna say 50. If you see that when they inserted that the patient's PA catheter was at 50, and you come in today and your coronary artery catheter is now at 40, it's been pulled back 10 centimeters. Where is the tip of our PA catheter now? It was in the pulmonary artery, but we pulled it back 10 centimeters. Where are we living now? Probably in my right ventricle, the right atrium. So what are you going to look at? I'm going to look at my EKG and go, woo, no wonder they're in bigeminy. Because my catheter got pulled back, and where's the tip of my catheter? It's bouncing around in my ventricle, having a party in there, and my ventricle's ticklish. And so it's shouting off all these, this ectopy, saying, what is going on here? Right? So if they're having some PVCs, I'm going to notify the doctor. If they're in VTAC, I'm going to pull my PA catheter out. I can do that without an order to save a life. I cannot put it in. I can never advance it or put it in, but I can pull it back. I would like to talk to the doctor before I do that, but if my patient's in VTAC and I know their PA catheter has been pulled back 10 centimeters, I'm going to pull it back enough to get that to stop, and then I'm going to call the doctor because VTAC's not good. If I, on insertion, it was at 50, and I come in today and I'm like, ooh, it's at 60, what am I going to look at? Where am I living now? I'm living way down deep in the tiny parts of the pulmonary artery. So at 50, with the balloon inflated, I could block forward flow. But you know what might happen at 60? At 60, I might block forward flow without inflating the balloon. So I'm going to look up at my PA waveform. What do I want to see? With the balloon deflated, what do I want to see? A pulmonary artery waveform. What if I look up there and see a wedge? Holy Toledo. I hope that hadn't been there very long. If my balloon is deflated and I see a wedge waveform, I am going to pull back. I'm not calling anybody. I am going to pull back until the wedge turns into a PA waveform, and then I'm going to call and notify somebody. Because we never want to wedge them more than about 10 seconds. And if I walk in and find it that way, that makes me very nervous. It also makes me worry about the integrity of that vessel now, because if it hasn't gotten good blood flow for quite some time, it may now be necrotic. And with that arterial pressurized blood, we may blow out the side of our pulmonary artery, and that's not really compatible with life. So that's very scary. We're also going to look at that sleeve. You remember in our picture of our PA catheter? See this sleeve that's on here? So that's not on there when they put it in place. It's like pulled back, and they put the PA catheter and they get it where they want it, and then the physician will pull that sleeve down and snap it into place here to keep all of this sterile. There's a little rubber gasket that's in here that kind of keeps this from moving too easily, but if you pull on it, it moves. It's not locked into place. It just has a little resistance as you move it. This sleeve should never have any blood or fluid in it. Unless, because we don't live in a black and white world, it got in there while they were inserting it. If you were there at insertion, and they got a little blood or a little fluid in the sleeve, when they close that sleeve, it's still going to be there because we're not magic. But if there was none there when we inserted, and you go back an hour later, and now there's fluid in here, you have a leak, and that's bad. It can be life-threatening, and you need to notify someone. Because if fluid is leaking out, blood can come back, and that can clog up our line, and air can go in, and that's an embolus, and we don't want that to happen. So you shouldn't see that you have a leak, and it's coming into this sleeve. You're going to take, you follow your facility policy, but I'm going to tell you, you've got that long line, and it's all full of fluid with all of those things that are hooked up to all this stuff, and all that's heavy. And then you put all that tension on that insertion site that doesn't lock into place, and what's going to happen? You're going to pull your PA catheter out. So what we do at my facility is we get that PA catheter and we curl it up on their chest and we tape it to secure it here so that all of that weight that's pulling with that IV fluid and all that is pulling on this tape and not on my insertion site. I'm moving my catheter. You're going to level it. You're going to zero it. You're going to make sure that that syringe that's on that red port is empty and that that port is unclamped. If I need to wedge my catheter, I'm going to take that syringe off. I'm going to put air in it. I'm going to put it on there, and I'm going to put air in until I get a wedged waveform. The most I can put in is 1.5 cc's. But I'm not going to put 1.5 cc's in. I'm going to put in enough to get a change in waveform because that's all I need. I'm going to take a picture on my screen, it's like a screenshot, and then I'm going to let the air out. And then I'm going to see what my wedge was. And all you do is you move a little line to see, okay, where does it flatten out and see what that number is on there. And if everybody does one in clinical, you'll say, hey, we want to see it if you'll have to wedge a PA. We do so much continuous cardiac output now that we don't a whole lot do manual stuff anymore. But I will tell you, now that we have a congestive heart failure cardiologist, we shoot manual cardiac outputs and do wedges all the time in CCU now. It's like the old nurses are coming back into their glory because we're teaching the young ones how to do this. So we do it much more often than we did 5 years ago. But when you're done, you're going to take that syringe off, you're going to get the air out of it, you're going to put it back on, and you're going to leave it unclamped. Because if that balloon has a little bit of residual air in it, we want it to be able to come out. We don't want to clamp it. But we don't want to store it with the syringe full of air, because when that patient rolls over in bed and pushes that syringe against their pillow, it can wedge, and that's bad. So unclamped but empty is how it should be stored. You're going to look at your waveforms and make sure you don't have a wedge waveform, you don't have a ventricular waveform, it's not causing feedback or PVCs to come across your monitor. You're going to trend your hemodynamics because you're going to think about my guy with a little broken liver and how if I were smarter, I might have been saved about 15 minutes and intervened sooner on a patient. And you're going to look at your chest x-ray. Now, we do not read chest x-rays. That's not what nurses do. But it is the expectation that you're looking at them. It is also the expectation that you're letting the doctor know if you see something that concerns you, because you're probably going to see it before they do. Because they come around about 4 a.m. at my facility and do all the chest x-rays, and the doctors usually get there about 6. So you've had plenty of time to look at that, if you're not shift, before the physicians start rounding. So we're going to look at this waveform again. We have our EKG, we have our ART line, we have our PA, we have our CVP, we have our O2 stat. And you can see how every one of them march along with the pulsatility of that EKG. This is not the lecture today, so we're not talking about those. So this is a beautiful chest x-ray of a patient that had a PA catheter inserted. I am not a radiologist, okay? But this is what I know about chest x-rays. There's supposed to be a lot of air in your chest, and the air is black. If you have a lot of white in your chest x-ray, then something's in there that's not supposed to be there if it's in the wrong place. So when you first look at a chest x-ray, this is what our intensivist taught me when I was a brand new nurse, and I still do this. When you first look at the chest x-ray, the first thing I look at is the cardiac silhouette of the heart. So y'all see that? You could draw a line around the edges of the heart. Your cardiac silhouette is supposed to be roughly half or less of the width of the chest. So, oh my gosh, I scrolled, I didn't need to, I'm sorry. So if I measure this, sometimes it doesn't touch over here. This one does, so it makes it real easy. But if you've got a heart just hanging out here in the middle, what you'll see the doctors do, or the nurses, the doctors can just look at it and tell because they're smarter than we are. If I go up there with my finger and measure the width of the chest, and then I move over to the edge, I'll go, yep, that's less than half, and that's normal. This one goes from the right side way over here. Is their silhouette normal? So I guarantee you, if we looked at the radiologist reading of this x-ray, it's going to say they had an enlarged cardiac silhouette. Their heart's too big. What's wrong with it? They probably have some congestive heart failure, cardiomyopathy, something that's causing their heart to be enlarged. So we see that first off. The next thing that he told me to look at is, first of all, your lung fields, you should have mostly black. This one has quite a bit of congestion. And what makes these little spotty areas up here is the vasculature. There's fluid in the vasculature that's sluggish, and so you have some congestion is what they usually read that as. Down here, you see this sharp V? That's beautiful. You should be able to see a sharp V. And the reason why we always do chest x-rays with them sitting up is because fluid goes down. And when the fluid goes down, right there where the diaphragm is, if you have a pleural effusion, then what you'll see is that this goes straight across instead of down like this, because the fluid will come sit right here. So pleural effusion is here. If they have infiltrates, it's up here. So infiltrates is fluid in the lung tissue itself, and that makes clouds. pleural effusion fills in your V down here, and that's fluid that's actually in the pleural sac. This patient's also intubated. You see this white line that comes down right here and stops? They're intubated. So that's their ET tube. It's radio opaque, and you can see where it is. Their their carina is right here. The carina, and it's hard to see, so if you can't see it, don't judge yourself for that, okay? Sometimes I have to squint and hold my head to the right and stick my tongue out and all that to see a carina. But what the carina is where the trachea splits into two main bronchus. And this is the carina. It's where it splits apart. So right here, you can see the carina. It's almost like a shadow rather than a true something you can see, if that makes sense. So my ET tip comes down. It's supposed to be about 2 centimeters above the carina, so that looks pretty good to me. You also have something that comes down here and we kind of lose, that's probably an NG tube that's going down. Then you've got this big honking thing that comes in over here, comes down here, makes a turn, goes up, and comes around this way. What do you think that is?
That's the PA.
It's a PA catheter, right? So I have an introducer up here. Sometimes you can see where it goes from fat to skinny, and that's where the end of the introducer is. I can't really so much see it on this one, but they have an IJ introducer with a PA catheter. This is a beautiful picture of what it's supposed to look like. The tip of the PA catheter is right here. It's not all the way out here. It's not down here. I don't think it's in the ventricle. I think it's in the pulmonary artery. I wouldn't know unless I inflated the balloon that I could truly wedge it, but it looks like I might could. This is a pretty picture of what I expect a chest x-ray to look like. So this patient has had CV surgery because they have wires. Their chest has been cracked open. They have sternal wires. Do they have a pleural effusion?
Yes.
It's hard to tell. My intensivist wouldn't like this x-ray because it kind of got cut off over here. They're so close that they cut off the bottom of the picture, but I don't see a pretty V, but I don't know if it's because it's not there or because they cut it off. So I don't know. I'm not a radiologist. I can't really tell you. I'm telling you they probably have an issue with this. I think we probably wouldn't be able to see it, but I don't really know for sure. They do have some clouds, right? These are just EKG leads. They look high-tech. It's just EKG leads that are on the chest, but they scare you the first time you pull one up on x-ray. Here's my introducer. That thing goes to a PA catheter, and it goes down. And where in the world is it going? Well, you have a right and a left pulmonary artery. It is much easier for it to curve this way, and because of the curve of the catheter in the box, it usually goes that way. But there's absolutely nothing wrong with this. It just went down the other pulmonary artery. So that's fine. It's atypical, but it's fine. Woo, cardiac silhouette, is it normal? Enlarged cardiac silhouette. This patient is obviously cardiomyopathy, congestive heart failure, has something.
I see the
lots of clouds. It is a cloudy day, right? So we have congestion in the lungs. That's not normal. Once again, I can't see the bottom. I can see where it might go. I can't tell you they don't have one, but they might not. But they've cut it off. So our intensivist would, at this point, be writing an email to somebody. We're calling somebody. Because now there's two x-rays I've looked at, and I can't even tell because it's not a good quality x-ray. And now you'll know why. Because they've cut off part of their picture. They don't know what's happening down there. They have also had CV surgery. You see the sternal wires in there? But they're harder to see because it's so cloudy in here. Here's my PA catheter, and it comes down, and they cut the bottom of it off, but here it goes, and it comes over here, and it's like, whoa, we're way over here, way out in the country, right? What are you going to look at? You see this chest x-ray, you haven't been in your patient's room yet, go look at my waveform. What am I worried about?
Wedge.
I'm looking for a wedge. Y'all are so good, because I'm worried that the catheter is so far in that even without the balloon inflated, I've wedged, and that's life-threatening. So I'm going to go look and see if I have a wedge. If I don't have a wedge, then the next thing I'm going to look at is say, okay, where is my catheter at? How many centimeters? And what was it when we inserted it? Has it been pushed in all the way? I mean, has this happened? Is this a change? Or has every x-ray since they put it in looked like this? And sometimes you'll just see one, but my concern with this is that it would be too far in. So if you're at the bedside and you're doing a wedge, I'm just showing you what that's going to look like. EKG is chugging along up here, doing its thing. Here's my pulmonary artery waveform. I have my scales pulled up, which is why I have these numbers over here. You're not going to see that all the time. And we're chugging along, and you inflate your balloon until you see a waveform change. And you stop, and this is my wedge waveform. So what I do is I freeze the screen, I let my balloon down, and then we have a little cursor that you can go, and you can move it down and line it up with this waveform here. And then it will tell you what it lines up to over here on the scale, and that's your wedge number. If I have a high wedge, what's going on? What's my wedge looking at? Hey, y'all. How y'all doing over there? What's my wedge looking at?
Sure.
Left side of the heart. If my wedge goes up, what happens?
You're backing up in the left.
My left ventricle is failing. Now, when y'all talked about congestive heart failure in second level, you were talking about left ventricular failure, but really you were talking about heart failure, the whole heart. We know that the left ventricle can fail and the right ventricle will be okay for a while. It's not going to stay that way. Because eventually, if the left ventricle fails and it backs up and backs up and back up, the right heart's going to then fail because the left ventricle is putting all the work on it. We also know if the right ventricle fails, the left ventricle is going to fail because if I'm not getting primed, I can't pump anything forward. So they are dependent on one another, but they don't happen at the same time. So if we wind up with a left, it helps us figure out what's the cause. Because if I'm in heart failure, I can't really determine if it's right versus left unless I have some more information, which is going, it's going to wind up being heart failure anyway, but it helps me treat them. We also have what's called an intra-aortic balloon pump. So we're done with we have what's called an intra-aortic balloon pump. Do y'all need a break?
Yes.
What time is it? I have 10:16. Y'all want to start back at like 10:25? Okay, 9 minutes? Okay.